and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Bernard Haish, and we're going to talk about his book, The Purpose Guided Universe, but we also just want to let you know that his other book, The God Theory, which we interviewed him on a couple of years ago, is also an excellent book, and we talked about him last week when we interviewed Dr. Peter Sturrock. However, before we get started, I would like to ask my listeners for a favor. This week, day before yesterday, I went up to my daughter's room to wake her up to get ready to go to school, and she was dead. And I jumped into survival mode and gave her, she's 16, by the way, her name is Jessica. And I jumped into survival mode, and I gave her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and she came back alive, but she was cold, and she was gray, and she was not breathing. So I just like prayers, if you don't mind, that she would heal in both her body and mind. And thank you. So tonight I'm coming to you from Black Mountain, North Carolina, and I'm at blackmountainsanctuary.org on the Internet. It's a wonderful place to come for a retreat or for seminars and lectures that are spiritual in nature. So, Dr. Haish, how are you? Thanks for coming on my show tonight. I'm sorry to preface like that, but I just had to do it.
No, it's fine. 100% fine. Glad to be here tonight.
Thank you. So before we get started with the interview, tell us a little bit about you and what you do and where people can find you.
Well, they can find information about me and my books on the website, thegodtheory.com. That's thegodtheory.com. My background is in astrophysics. I'm an astrophysicist. I've done several decades worth of work primarily on NASA contracts to analyze NASA data from satellites to help design experiments for space. And basically, I pursued a career in astrophysics since the time of my graduation with a PhD from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Written lots of scientific papers, but I've also been very interested in the spiritual side of things for a long time. I decided that it was about time in my life to try to put these things together, to try to see whether I could come up with a belief system that makes sense, that avoids any conflict between science and spirituality. And that's what I try to present in my two books, The God Theory and The Purpose Guided Universe.
Well, I think they're very important books. That's also my passion. So I have a lot of questions for you. My listeners are typically, understand. Well, we're used to having physicists and engineers talk about consciousness and biologists, you know, like Bruce Lipton and such. So people on my show typically understand more information than the average person. So I'm going to ask you some questions specifically about consciousness, but I also want to ask you some questions about science and consciousness from the perspective of an astrophysicist, because we've never been able to have anybody even on the show to think about it from that perspective. So I may ask you some stuff that you say, you know, I don't know, but here's what I think about it, and that's okay. Okay, so I hope you don't mind me asking. If you don't know or don't want to answer what I ask you, just tell me that, and I'll move on to the next question.
Okay.
Okay. So my first question is, so we can all be on the same page about what we're talking about, is what is your definition of consciousness?
I guess it's the one thing I can't answer in any detail because I don't have one. But what I do have is a sort of an operational perspective, which is consciousness is that thing that you have that is the most essential part of yourself, the one thing that you couldn't let go of even if you wanted to. So it's the knowledge of your own existence and of your own being at a fundamental level that transcends any physical knowledge, any mathematical knowledge. I guess I would sooner not believe that 1 + 1 = 2 than that I don't have consciousness. So
okay.
I'm kind of stepping around the definition. I don't think I have one, but I know it when I see it.
So let me ask you this then. Do you simply equate it with awareness, or do you also believe it to be the ground of all being as well, like the irreducible unit maybe?
I think the two are about the same thing, because I think to be aware and to have a consciousness that somehow shares in what we'll talk about tonight, which I think is a universal consciousness, that they're both the same part of they're part of the same thing. I think you can't have awareness without consciousness. I don't think it's possible to differentiate awareness from any kind of knowledge that we have that we acquire through our consciousness.
Do you think that consciousness is in gradients?
It is what, please?
Do you think consciousness is in gradient? In other words, you know, you talk to one person, maybe a fundamentalist, and you try to talk to them about non-duality, and they have no idea what you're talking about and will argue you on it. Or maybe the radicalism that's going on in the Muslim and the Southern Baptist communities. You know, how do you account for those drastically different perspectives of the world when everybody's a human being?
Well, that's a very good question. I guess there are degrees of difference in the level of consciousness. I mean, there obviously are degrees of difference in intelligence. We've measured that for decades. You know, not necessarily perfectly, but we've measured IQs for decades. And so certainly there are people that are smart and there are people that are dumb, and lots of people in between. And I guess that same sort of division would apply to consciousness itself, I would say.
Okay. What is your definition of mind? And also, when you answer that question, do you differentiate? And, you know, linguistics is a problem when you're talking about consciousness, so I'm going to do the best I can with my own limited vocabulary. Do you differentiate between what I would call big mind and little mind?
I'm not quite sure what you call big mind and little mind, but I think I do, because what I'm going to propose, what I talk about in my books, is the idea that there is a great universal consciousness that is the basis of everything, but that we share that same consciousness, that in a very much smaller packet, or a smaller package, we're the same thing, that we are, for example, like candle flames that come from the same bonfire. Same stuff, the same essential element, but of course at a far, far smaller and much more diluted scale.
That's a good analogy. I like that. Okay, do you have an opinion on whether you think, you could probably figure out my show is more like a deposition, because that's my background is in litigation. Do you have an opinion as to where consciousness is a wave or a field or both or something else?
You know, I think it's something we don't have a physical description for, in part because I think it's not physical to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the source of the physical universe, but also because we just haven't studied it from that perspective. The perspective we study from in terms of modern science has to do with neurology and chemistry and so on, purely mechanistic views of the mind and consciousness. And on the spiritual side, we really haven't had any scientific investigations. People from the spiritual side, you know, they may have transcendent mystical experiences, but those are done, those are had on their own, sort of their own sort. They don't have any scientific basis behind them. You can't do an experiment or an observation on them. So we don't really have a good scientific definition of consciousness that is of the sort that I think consciousness is, which is not something that simply arises out of brain chemistry.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Okay. There's a phrase in your book, I want to ask you what it means. What do you mean when you said the wave function is really the atoms changing? What does that mean?
Well, yeah, this gets us into quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics, there is a wave function associated with everything, every particle. That wave function describes sort of where the particle is likely to be found, because interestingly, at this quantum level, you can't pinpoint things precisely. There's a thing called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which precludes your ever getting the exact position, the exact motion of any particle to infinite precision. And that means that you can describe where a particle is liable to be found in a measurement via this thing called a wave function. This picture that is kind of a fuzzy, undulating sort of cloud of probability where something will be found if you make the right measurement. And people oftentimes have the impression, even in science, even scientists do, that this wave function is something over and above the particle itself, that somehow a particle resides inside this fuzzy wave function. They're two separate things, but in fact, that's not the case. The wave function, which is a spread-out thing that can be in more than one place at the same time, is actually the same thing as the particle itself, except that it hasn't been measured yet. So the wave function describes where the particle is liable to be found.
So would that be similar to a droplet of water on the wave in the ocean?
Well, it might be.
It's all one thing, yet it can be separated too?
The analogy breaks down a little bit because the wave function can turn into the particle when you make a measurement of where it is. You make the measurement, and based on the probability that's in the wave function, you'll find a particle to be here or there in one box or the other. But you have to make a measurement, and that's where, in fact, consciousness enters into the equation for quantum mechanics when you make measurements. The measurements require consciousness to complete themselves.
Okay. That brings me to my next question, where you talk about the switch setting being set to 1 or 2.
Yes.
You remember that?
Yes.
Is the chooser mechanistic, or is it intention? I mean, who set the switch?
Of course, it's difficult for your listeners to understand because the switch is a figure in my book.
They get it, most of them. I mean,
yeah.
The idea is that
we choose as experimenters to make one measurement or the other. But what's interesting, let me give an example of a photon experiment that's along the lines of what we're talking about. Not exactly, but I think it would make it clearer. Let's assume I shoot a photon, which is just a bundle of light, a quantum bundle of light. I shoot a photon down a tube. Now, halfway down that tube, there's a beam splitter where the tube forks into two other tubes. Call them path A and path B. So when the photon gets to that beam splitter, it's got three choices it has to choose from. It can fork into A, fork into path B, or it can split and go into both path A and B. Very bizarre, but those are the three choices it has. Now, how does it know which choice to make? Well, the choice depends on what kind of measurement it's going to encounter beyond the beam splitter. So depending on what it's going to encounter, which it hasn't encountered yet, it's going to make the right choice. So somehow it knows what lies ahead. Even spookier is that a clever quantum scientist can arrange to postpone the choice of measurement until after the photon has passed the point of no return. So a photon gets to a beam splitter, doesn't know what it's going to encounter further down the line. In fact, it's not even been determined yet by the experimenter, and still it makes the right choice to complete the experiment. This is bizarre, but this is quantum mechanics.
All right, what does that mean to our everyday life? What does that mean about consciousness or free will or intention? What does that mean?
It's got a huge amount to do with free will, because prior to quantum mechanics, everything was regarded as being totally mechanistic, totally deterministic, so that, for example, what I choose to do after breakfast in the morning could have been predicted a billion years ago if someone had been smart enough to know the position and velocity of every atom in the universe. You could have predicted that Mozart would write his opera, The Marriage of Figaro, by looking at what the Earth was like when the dinosaurs roamed.
Mm-hmm.
All this was totally determined from start to finish, which, of course, leaves no way for free will to operate whatsoever. So a very depressing view of things. But when quantum mechanics came along, it was clear that things are not this cut and dry. Things are not determined at that level. And there's a built-in fuzziness in the universe. And I think that built-in fuzziness is what gives us our wiggle room for free will.
Okay. Free will is one of my passions. I just desperately think about it and try to figure it out all the time. So I'm going to ask you some more questions there, if you don't mind. So do we have complete free will? Or do we have free will to place an intention and hope that intention will occur based on, I guess, non-randomness, a thought or something? I'm not really sure. Can that be enough of a question for you to answer?
Well, I'm not sure. Let me venture into it and see how far I get. I do believe we have total free will. I think that there are some constraints that we place on ourselves and others do on us. Yeah, intention, because I think intention can somehow shape our reality, although to a very limited extent.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at any point in time, even if we're confronted with something that has a high probability of becoming the fact, that we still have a choice to say no, a choice to do the opposite. I think, you know, at any point we can always back out and say, no, we're going to do something different than we thought we should do or thought that the universe is telling us to do. And when I say universe is telling us to do, I'm using the word universe in kind of a new agey way, which I usually don't, being a scientist. But I think that we come into this life with a general outline of what we're going to do in it. And so we have the free will to accept or not accept some of the forks in the road that we have probably programmed for ourselves when we come into life. But it's our choice whether or not to go down one path or another at any time.
Okay. If we have complete free will, excuse me, then would... how would anything bad ever happen? How would we get lost? How would we forget a meeting? How would we have a flat tire? How would my daughter die? Because certainly if I had complete free will, you know, none of those things would ever happen to me.
Well,
How do you account for that? I mean, have you thought about that? How would that account? How would having complete free will account for those events to occur?
Well, I see no problem at all there, because free will doesn't mean we have anything we want. Free will means that when we're confronted with something, we get to choose. It doesn't mean we get to have what we want. It just means we get to choose what we're going to do based upon what's right in front of us.
Okay, so your free will would literally be, how are you going to react to a situation?
Exactly.
Okay.
I do not see free will as being
different than manifesting mass or changing your reality. It's
exactly.
How you respond. Okay. That's what I was looking for. Okay. Well, what do you believe to be the source of creativity? Is it us? Is it consciousness, big mind? I mean, big mind to me is like the God head.
Mm-hmm.
And little mind to me would be like our thing that we, our racing thoughts that we think are conditioned minds every day. So however you phrase that, what would be the source of creativity? Is it us or something else?
I think it's us, because I think that if we share the same consciousness as the creator, as the intelligence behind the universe, that intelligence is creative. I think that's one of the fundamental attributes of this thing, although I think there's really no... Well, I get into trouble when I say attributes, because I'm going to say later on probably that this intelligence has no literal attributes, because it's not a physical being as we're
mm-hmm.
thinking of. But still, I would say creativity is sort of an aspect of this intelligence. If we are really the same consciousness at a smaller scale, then the creativity that goes with that consciousness goes with ours as well.
Do you think that we have to get into... To be evolved, to be able to tap into that? Because, you know, like for instance, in Irvin Laszlo, I mean, he says, you know, I don't know how to do what I'm doing. I just know how to play the piano like that. Or I just know the systems theory work. I just know it. I don't think about it. I just know it. So does it just drop in? But do you have to be tuned into a frequency or a resonance or...
In order to be creative?
Yeah.
Well, it probably helps. It probably helps if you are sort of tuned into your higher nature, because I think we are creatures of the body, of living in physical bodies, and we're also creatures that have a spiritual being, a spiritual life, a spiritual aspect. And I think it's that spiritual aspect that we can tune into and try to have a harmony between what we do here in the physical realm with what we came here to do, which is known to our greater conscious self in that other realm.
Okay. Now I'm going to move into some of the science that I've always wanted to know. From your factual scientific perspective, is the universe accidental or purposeful? And I understand you may have to insert some opinions, and that's okay with me. I'd just like to know what the opinions are.
Yeah. Well, there are two ways to look at it. In fact, let me back up and say that there's a reason behind this question, and that is that it's been discovered over the last 10 to 20 years or so that the universe has a number of very special properties that make it friendly to life. Some of the laws of nature, some of the constants of nature, are such as to be conducive to life originating and evolving on the surface of the planet. So I say we have a very life-friendly universe, and that, in fact, is now pretty much regarded as a mainstream conclusion in astrophysics. Question is it accidental or is it purposeful? Well, of course, in science, you want to investigate things from a non-spiritual perspective. And so it's assumed that if our universe appears special to us, that's got to imply that there are many other universes that are different than ours, so that we can be in this one because we couldn't be in any other one. But there have to be lots of others to sort of explain away the apparent specialness of our own universe. And that's what you'll find in, for example, the new book by Hawking that just came out called The Grand Design. You'll find that explanation for why our universe seems to have these special properties, and that's called the multiverse theory, because it postulates there are many, many universes other than ours, and none of them are special, not a one. Now, my perspective is that I take the same evidence for our special universe and say, well, if it looks special, it may be because it is. And I suspect it's because this great intelligence wanted a universe to originate in which in which life forms could originate and evolve so that he, she, it, could enter into those life forms and experience what it's like to live as a physical being in such a universe. Now, you can take either one of those explanations. There's basically zero evidence on both sides. If you really don't like the idea of a God, then take the multiverse explanation, it's perfectly fine. I don't deny that. On the other hand, I don't think that's the right explanation. And I think there's even a slight bit of evidence in favor of my interpretation, because if you take the mystical and transcendent experiences of people throughout history, they point to a mind meld with God that suggests that, yes, the universe is not just an accident. It's the product of a great thought, a great thought of a great intelligence.
So tell me the difference, or do you have a distinct definition difference for parallel universe and parallel dimension? What's the difference between those things? And I'm going to ask some questions after that.
I don't know. The possibility of other dimensions is mathematically easy to justify. In string theory and M theory, which are the forefront physics theories trying to explain everything, you need to have other dimensions to make the mathematics consistent. Now, in those other dimensions, there could be other universes. So, yes, both other universes and other dimensions are thought to exist in string theory and M theory, but those are, there is no hard evidence for these things yet. There's merely mathematical consistency and the theoretical motivation.
So the M theory of the unified string theory, for my listeners, please tell us, do you support that or not?
I don't support it, but not because I'm particularly knowledgeable about it. I've never really studied it in any detail, but I just, as have most physicists, I've not studied it either, by the way. It's a very esoteric aspect of physics. It takes years of specialized training just to participate in, so you really have to be an expert just in that to understand it. But the reason I'm skeptical of it is because there are some people that have studied it, that have written books that are skeptical of it, and people know a lot more about it than I do, that say, well, we've gotten to the point where we've created this great mathematical structure, but there's not one shred of physical evidence, and even worse than not having any physical evidence, there's not even the chance of getting any physical evidence, because the conditions you'd have to have do any string theory measurements, string theory experiments, are beyond anything we could possibly build even in the future. Something like a particle accelerator the size of the solar system. Well, that ain't going to happen. It can't happen. So string theory and M theory suffer from the fact that there's no evidence for them, and in fact, it's not liable to be any evidence in any time soon, if ever.
What does the M theory of the unified string theory, what is it basically in a blurb tell us? Or trying to tell us? What is it trying to tell us?
Well, the M stands for, in fact, I'm not going to tell you what the M stands for, because that varies depending on who you talk to.
Okay.
Some say it just stands for mystery.
By consciousness, nobody knows, huh?
Well, actually, I think it stands for membrane. But the idea is that there are other dimensions, and these other dimensions, there may be other things, other universes that have different properties, that may have different numbers of dimensions, whose dimensions may have different properties than ours. For example, space and time are both dimensions. But they're obviously very different. I mean, no one can confuse space and time with each other. They're very different dimensions, but they're both dimensions. There may be dimensions that have properties very different from either one of those two.
Mm-hmm.
Dimensions that are not space, that are not time, that are something we can't even imagine. So that's the stuff that M theory and string theory study. But beyond that, you know, the details of that, you'd have to get an M theory expert on the show to talk about.
So one thing that I do want to ask, and you may or may not know this answer, is the M theory of the unified string theory, doesn't it talk about 11 parallel universes?
There are various ones, various models, various developments of string theory. I think 11 dimensions is the most popular, but I've seen numbers as high as 26. It all depends on the mathematics.
I've seen numbers of thousands, and depending on who you're talking to, tens or three, but for some reason the 111 resonates with me, because it seems like to me that if the universe rotates, and if we have, we would have to have an odd number to keep it from collapsing upon itself, would it not?
No, in fact, the universe is not rotating as far as I know. It'd be hard to measure. It'd be hard to measure the rotation of the universe.
So you're telling me that the universe doesn't rotate?
That's right. Because what would it measure with? What would it rotate with respect to? There's nothing external to compare it to.
You're the only person I've ever had to tell me that. So that's interesting. So what is the science?
Our galaxy rotates. The galaxy rotates, but the universe does not. fact, whether the universe rotates or not, it's not a scientific question because you don't have any point of comparison.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So is it a perspective or a fact?
That what?
That the universe rotates.
No,
I guess we have to define what universe is.
The universe being everything that there is out there. There's no observation, no measurement that would indicate any rotation. I think in part because, probably entirely because, to have a rotation, you have to have some point of reference. And there is no external point of reference.
I got you. But our galaxies rotate.
Our galaxy rotates.
Okay. So would there not have to be some kind of odd number of them to keep them from collapsing?
No.
Does that make sense what I'm saying?
No.
Okay. We'll move on to the next thing then. That's all right. I'm a mystic, so I see things, and sometimes I don't have words to describe them.
That's fine.
You know? Okay. How can consciousness affect, or our conscious awareness affect, planetary destruction? And is there any scientific evidence supporting that?
No. I know of no evidence supporting any planetary destruction, nor of any evidence supporting that our consciousness has anything to do with it. There are a lot of sort of urban legends out there about things changing in the solar system, but none of these things are scientific.
You were talking about, I can't find it in your book, I didn't realize I would need to locate this, but you said something about it's the time to become conscious because things are happening in the universe and we raising our consciousness. Shoot, if I could only find this.
Well, let me back up though and say, I wrote things are changing on the planet, not the universe. There's
yes.
a huge, huge difference.
Okay. Well, I said planetary destruction. Consciousness.
Well, if you mean our planet, I mean, yes, we have an impact here because we're part of the environment. But do we have any impact on Mars or Jupiter or Saturn? No, we don't.
Okay. And so what are you trying to tell us when you say that? What do we need to do?
Well, we need to change our way of thinking because clearly at a physical level, we're destroying the planet. I mean, we're having global warming. Species are dying out. Now, there are obviously things that we're doing that are not good for the environment or even for ourselves. Then on a metaphysical level, I mean, we ask ourselves, well, what's happening in the world today? What forces are there that are out there that are just trying to take us backwards in time, such as the fundamentalist Islamic stuff? And I think to have a world that not only is environmentally and ecologically healthy, but that is metaphysically healthy, we've got to change our consciousness as human beings. We've got to think of ourselves differently. Instead of thinking of ourselves as simply chemical machines that can do what they want because, after all, you know, when we're gone, it's all over with for us. That we view ourselves as incarnations of this intelligence that wants to experience reality and that we have greater powers than we realize, but unless those powers are manifest in some benevolent way, they could be just yet another force of evil that's used by those who would like to control the rest of the world.
Do you think that creating mass cohesion of thought can accelerate the healing of the world?
I suspect so. I suspect it can. I don't know of any hard evidence of that, but I suspect so.
I guess I was thinking about, you know, Robert John's ping pong ball thing, you know, experiment where they used intention to move them to the left. If that was only one person at a time sometimes, so if we had masses doing that.
Yeah, I'm well aware of that work. I've known them for years and years. So there is evidence there that the mind, so the question is, can the mind control anything physical? And the answer is, yeah, at a very small level it can. And maybe at a much larger level if people work together, but we just don't know how far that can be taken, nor what the limitations are, nor whether it's possible for human beings to cooperate at that level.
Makes me wonder how that ties into free will, but I won't make you go there. The next thing I wanted to ask you about is, what is the difference between dark matter and dark energy, and what is the relationship to those things, to consciousness, and to our everyday lives? I mean, how do those things affect our lives, or how can we affect those things?
Well, first of all, they're totally different things. Dark energy has been discovered since the late 1990s to be something that underlies the universe. It's everywhere in the universe. It causes an acceleration of the expansion of the universe. So even sitting in your office and I and mine, we're sort of in the midst of a sea of dark energy that's causing the universe to accelerate, but we can't see it or feel it. Dark matter, on the other hand, is positively gravitational. Dark energy has a positive gravity. We don't know what it is either. So we have these two things, dark energy and dark matter. We don't know what either one of them are. So I can't say that they have any impact on the everyday life of a human being because we can't even directly detect these things with our best astronomical equipment. But it's there. It's real. We need to have them to explain what we do see in the universe. But in terms of any relationship to consciousness, we don't even know what the stuff is yet, much less what impact it would have on human beings. And I suspect that there's none. I suspect it's sort of like gravity. Gravity doesn't change your... Gravity doesn't alter your mood.
Another thing that interests me is I think about hydrogen a lot. I don't know why, but I do. And I was reading, is it deuterium? Mm-hmm. Is that the way you say that word?
Yes.
How is that hydrogen different, and is that what makes up the black energy?
No. Deuterium comes in heavy. Well, deuterium is simply a hydrogen atom with an added neutron. And so that's what you can make water out of that. It's called heavy water. But in terms of any effect it has, I think it's lethal to drink a lot of heavy water. But it's really nothing unusual. It's simply the hydrogen atoms in that water have an extra neutron in the nucleus.
So what does it do? What is its purpose? Is it a building block?
No, it's something that occurs during atomic transformations. In nuclear reactors, it occurs in fusion.
Okay.
It's just a byproduct. It's just something that occurs in atomic reactions.
Okay, going back to the dark matter or the dark energy, how does that expansion of the universe affect our lives or our consciousness? Either one. I'm not sure how to ask the question.
I don't see how it can. I mean, it's something that happens way out there. I did say dark energy is everywhere. In fact, it is everywhere. It's in my room and in your room, too. But it's not something that has any direct impact on human beings. It's just,
does it speed up time?
No.
Does nothing?
All it does is it causes the universe to accelerate. It's an anti-gravity force. And so it has no more effect on the human being than saying, well, I'm sitting in my office, and gravity is making me do this or that. Well,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't really.
And it couldn't have any effect on, Noetic Science has finished that study a few years ago. I can't remember if it was 20 or 30 years that more people since the early to mid-90s have had spontaneous enlightenment experiences than ever before in the history of time. It couldn't have anything to do with that?
No.
Okay. Do you know anything that could have anything to do with that?
I suppose just the overall transformation of human beings, if that's taking place, if there's some shift happening on a conscious level that is now translating into something on a physical level, maybe. But I don't know, beyond saying the words, what that would mean.
Okay. Do you think that, Bill Tiller has been doing work with magnetic monopoles. Do you think that, can you see, as a scientist, any relevance between magnetic monopoles and consciousness?
Well, first of all, I don't think he's actually got a magnetic monopole. They've been searched for years, and no one has ever found one.
Well, he says he has.
I'd be very skeptical. I guess I wouldn't believe that until I had some evidence.
You know Tiller, right?
I do know him. I do know him. He's a very good guy.
Yeah.
But that's a very out there claim, and I wouldn't believe that without having a ton of evidence.
He said, and there's another group. I actually started researching on it when he first told me about that. But I have typed transcripts of some of the shows where I interview certain people.
Yeah.
You're going to be one of them because I'm going to put them in a book one day.
Okay.
And I have the transcripts where we talked about that. If you'd like to read them, I'll send them to you, where Bill talks about his magnetic monopoles.
Okay.
But then after he talked about it, I went searching on the Internet, and I found one other group in Japan who's claiming the same thing, which I thought was kind of interesting.
It's a very tough scientific experiment to do. It's not something that's reliable to just turn up, so...
Yeah, I mean, it was one thing on the entire Internet that I could find. And I do litigation, so I research a lot, and that's all I could find. But anyway, we have about 15 or so minutes, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what you want to talk about now that I've asked all my questions.
Well, I guess what I have to talk about is why my concept of what I call the God theory, why that's important. Now, first of all, let me preface that by saying that what I've written about in these two books, there's nothing original that I've discovered myself. In fact, if it would be, if it were totally original, I would say you shouldn't read my books, because I'm trying to present age-old wisdom, the sort of collective knowledge of the human race regarding spiritual matters, in a way that's updated and modern and ties in with science. But there's nothing there that you should attribute strictly to me, because what I'm trying to present is a view of the truth. And that truth is not going to be something I discovered in the 21st century. It's going to be something that's been part of our knowledge all along. So I've written a book about, these two books about the perennial philosophy, which is the commonality of the concepts in all the world's religions. And Aldous Huxley wrote about this in the 1940s. That's been a great source of, a source for both the books. It contains the basic landscape of what spirituality is all about and what God is all about. And I wrote these books basically as a public service, because it's not going to help me professionally to write these sort of books, because scientists are not encouraged to think along these lines.
Yeah, I'm sure it's been a hard road for you to do that.
It has been.
For most people, it has been.
But it's important, because I think that unless we get away from two things, one, get away from the scientific hubris that says we soon will explain everything in terms of this matter and energy and science has all the answers. On the other side, the claims of the fundamentalist religion that the answers will be found in the Bible, the Quran, or wherever you choose to place your emphasis, and you have the doctrines and dogmas to believe, I think both these sides are wrong. Scientism is wrong and fundamentalism is wrong. And I'm trying to present something that is consistent with both a spiritual perspective and a scientific one. And I think I've succeeded. I think I've shown that it's possible to have a pretty sophisticated view of God and ourselves as human beings and spiritual beings, and science with its findings about the fine-tunings of the universe that make a coherent picture, that fit together.
I think you did an excellent job, and I thank you for doing that and having the courage to do it, particularly being a scientist, and I know you're subjected to a lot of probably abuse by it. Everybody else has been that I've interviewed about that. So another thing that I've asked people, the scientists, is most of them have had to have a dark night of the soul in their life before they were able to see this big picture. Did that happen to you?
Well, it's hard to say. Maybe a gray night of the soul. It's a dark night of the soul. Because I'm not a very experiential person. What I've written in the books is pretty much intellectual. It's the stuff that's come to me through logic, through reasoning, through analogy, and not because I've had any great revelatory moments. So by the same token, without having had those, I haven't had the despair that goes with the dark night of the soul.
Uh-huh.
So I feel sometimes kind of pessimistic about the way things are heading. And the willingness of people to believe the most silly things that turn out to be destructive for ourselves. So there has been a sense of, well, it's interesting to know these things that I've written about, but is the human race actually going to succeed in transforming itself to make these possibilities real, or are we going to sort of stumble along until finally things get to be critical and we wind up with a planet that's in serious danger?
Have you thought about enlightenment and how you... Have you ever seen the... Never mind. Can't think what this... It was the movie. There was a movie made about it, though. About consciousness and when people evolve. What's the name of that movie? Oh, well, I'll move on.
Talking about What the Bleep?
No, it was James Redfield, Celestine Prophecy. Did you see
I've read that.
Did you see the movie?
No.
Because I read the book too, but I didn't get the same thing from the book as I got from the movie. So what happened in the movie was whenever the time came, whatever that time is, that people started... their bodies started vibrating at a higher speed. So they were not visible to the people who weren't conscious or spiritually evolved.
Yes.
Is that something that's possible?
I wouldn't know. It's certainly not possible scientifically in terms of the science we know today. Is it possible beyond that science? Who can say? I can't.
I was just curious. I've never asked anybody about that before, but... popped into my head for some reason. So what about your work with Peter Sturrock? I had not connected the two of you. Can you tell us anything about what you did with him?
Well, that goes back a long, long way. It goes back to his founding the Society for Scientific Exploration back in the 1980. A society that's dedicated to providing a professional forum for scientists to present results that are not within the boundaries of ordinary science, that are at the frontiers, perhaps slightly beyond. So he was president of that society. He ran the society for many years, probably 25 years or so. And I came into it very early on when I was quite a bit younger. And I took on the editorship of the journal for over 10 years. Ran that journal together with my wife, Marcia Sims. and we ran the Journal of Scientific Exploration. So I had a long and close association with Peter for many years.
What would you say would be some of the most mind-sticking things that you allowed to be published?
We did a lot of them. Now, I have to point out that a lot of the things we published, for all we know, could wind up being wrong, because we were a journal that was open to any kind of new ideas, provided that they were discussed and analyzed and treated in a rigorous sort of scholarly fashion. So it was not the subject matter that was the determinant whether or not we would publish something. It was how well the study was done. So we published on everything from extrasensory perception to UFOs to cryptozoology to reincarnation to, I mean, you name it, we published on it. And I would say I'd be surprised if the majority of it turned out to be true, but, you know, our task was not to try to sift out the truth, but rather to provide a forum where things can be logically presented as a way to provide a repository of data for science to study eventually, to try to find out whether there are.
Is that available to everybody to look at?
Sure, anyone can subscribe to it, and anyone can become an associate of the society.
Okay, and what's the website? Are you still involved with that?
I'm still involved. I'm on the council, actually. It's called scientificexploration.org. Let me say that again. scientificexploration.org.
I think it's important for people to know that. Now, one last thing I'm going to ask you before I let you speak for another few minutes before the show is over. Do you think that we literally create our own physical reality, first of all? And then second of all, what we are living today, when did we create it? Did we create it today, or did we create it 10 years ago?
I think in the broadest sort of strokes, yes, we do create our own reality, but in a very limited kind of way. We can't just, for example, I was reading the book called The Secret, which I think is tremendous hyperbole. I mean, there are a couple of good ideas in it, but it's been blown way out of proportion. And they claim in there that, you know, all you have to do is visualize and meditative on what you want, and you will get it. You will get everything you want. Well, of course, that's nonsense. You can't get everything you want.
I can't agree with you more.
Pardon me?
I can't agree with you more.
About the book, yeah. It was a total hyperbole.
Yeah.
But I do think at a deeper level, yes, we do create reality, but we do it in a way that has to involve the collective interactions of 6 billion human beings that are alive at a given time, perhaps other entities in other realms that help us design whatever our future is going to be. I think it's a very complicated process. To some limited extent, we can try to visualize for ourselves what we want. But, and when you ask the question, when was this determined, what we're living in, I would say that whatever this realm of consciousness is that we reside in as spiritual beings probably does not have any space and time. So I don't think you could say, well, we designed the Earth of 2010 back in the spiritual days of 1990-something or other. It's a question that doesn't really... can't be answered, because I think there isn't any space and time as we know it in that realm. It's something different.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So do you have any opinion whatsoever about all of the information coming out about 2012?
Yeah, I think it's all nonsense, frankly.
I have no idea what to think. I really don't have an opinion on it, but I don't know what to think. I'm always curious to ask.
I've heard lots of urban legends about it. For example, we're crossing a photon belt. Well, there's no such thing as a photon belt. Photons can't do that. They can't travel in circles. So the idea of a photon belt is nonsense. The planet Nibiru coming is nonsense, because if it were to do that, it would be here by now, because we know exactly how fast an object can move and still be part of our solar system. So there's a lot of nonsense going on.
We have about 4 or 5 minutes. Is there any, I love science. Is there any scientific information from your perspective, from your field of study, that you can enlighten us with that helps us better understand consciousness, even if it's not fully finished studying it? Is there something out there? Is there something going on, some research going on somewhere that would interest us as it relates to consciousness?
Well, for consciousness, you have to turn to quantum mechanics, which is not easy to do because it's a difficult subject. Although really to understand the deep implications of quantum mechanics, you don't need to be a PhD. In fact, you don't even need to be a mathematician. The logic of quantum mechanics is pretty well outlined in a book that came out recently called Quantum Enigma. It's by a couple of University of California Santa Cruz physics professors who talk about the course they teach to undergraduates on quantum mechanics, but quantum mechanics not with respect to calculating wave functions and tricky things like that, but simply with respect to the logic, the philosophy of quantum mechanics, which they claim, and I believe, any high school student can understand the deepest implications of quantum mechanics without any mathematics. And they have to do with the way the consciousness plays a role in making measurements. And so if you want to look for something that, you know, is kind of mind-boggling and at the same time scientifically rigorous, I would say look at their book on quantum mechanics, because that's where the consciousness aspect comes into physics.
Who is it? Is there the guys?
It's, what's the name? Rosenblum and Kuttner. Rosenblum and Kuttner are the two authors of the book,
okay,
called Quantum Enigma.
That sounds like something I would like to read. All right, tell us one more time how we can find you and anything else that you want to talk about in the next minute or 2 minutes that
yeah.
we haven't that you'd like to say.
Well, you can find me at thegodtheory.com. That has the preface to both the books and the table of contents and, of course, the buttons to click on to take you to Amazon to buy the book. Both books, actually. I prefer you buy both books. The books are for sale on Amazon and bookstores and Barnes & Noble. And, you know, what I try to do in these books is to provide the best possible approach to the science and spirituality that is respectful and compatible to both sides, and something that you can believe in, I think, if you are caught between the scientists on the one hand claiming, oh, there is no mystery in life other than what science investigates, there's no spirituality. And on the other hand, what you hear in the churches oftentimes is you have to follow our dogma or no dogma. In between that, there's a whole world of possibilities, and I explore those in the books.
They're excellent, Dr. Hayes. Thank you. Thank you for being brave enough to do it. Thank you for taking the time to come and talk about these things with me.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.